The Winners Club is the weekly podcast that shares the highlights and insights from some of the most meaningful and impactful conversations from the number one community on Clubhouse, The Winners Club.
Good evening, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to this special Winners Club room, The Art of Innovation. What an intriguing title this is. From the Prince of Wales to NASA. Fantastic conversation that will be curated and hosted by our very own Winners Club fave, John O'Brien, MBE. We'll be handing over the controls to John. After this musical interlude, enjoy this conversation, another unique room from the Winners Club.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Paul. Paul, for opening the room. Thank you, everybody, for coming in and starting so early. For some strange reason, I got pinged into another room on innovation, but I can assure you this is the room on innovation to be in. Chris, great to be sitting here next to you. How are things with you in Pasadena?
Couldn't be better, John. It's a pleasure to be here with you. It's bright and sunny. It's about 70 degrees. Sorry to the rest of the world, but we're feeling good out here. So.
No, it's good out here as well. So you're either in the morning, in the afternoon, or like the UK, we're getting into our evening, but it's been a great sunny day. Chris, you and I have been chatting for a few weeks now about getting this room together. It's going to be great fun. We've got friends coming from all over the places that we obviously operate it, so that's going to be good. And I'm going to start, we'll start to see, we've got some friends on stage already who are going to contribute, and we'll also see who else is coming up. But folks, today, this is the room about the art of innovation. And we use that title because Chris and I thought, actually, there is something special about this incredible word that allows us to go beyond what we would see as the normal state. And just to sort of kick this off then, in terms of getting a definition in our mindset, if we take a standard sort of innovation definition, it is the creation, development, and implementation of something new, a new product, a service, or the aim of improving something, including either efficiency or indeed the state that we're in. So it is a creative process, and it's about changing the state of either something. It could be a product, it could even be the conditions that we're working in. I'm John O'Brien, I'm part of the Winners Club. It's a great club. If you're not a member already, please tap on the little green house that's above Chris's head at the moment. They do great rooms, and it's a pleasure to be associated with it. My start point, before I just get Chris to say a few words, is, although a lot of what I'm responsible for in the last 30 years is what would be termed social and business innovation, I spent 10 years as a British infantry officer, and my start point for innovative thinking is ironically there, because contrary to a lot of what people think, the military is not just about command and control. So what I believe was my personal capacity to then go on and create innovative solutions for the Prince of Wales, which we may talk about, and other things since, was absolutely born out of that formative period of learning as an infantry officer to be innovative in coming up with solutions. So I want to go to the hot mic there. I want to just welcome our good friend Keith is also in. Keith at the time.
But I'm How are you?
Hi, Keith. We'll come to you in a moment. It's great to see you here. But I want to hand over to Chris, really. And so, you know, we've got some fantastic people on stage, including our good friend, our mutual friend who brought us together, was Keith from Time, which we'll come on to in a moment. But Chris, you have innovation in your job title. So we're looking at you, innovation, NASA. Those two words are just an extraordinary magnet for new thinking. So can you tell us and tell the room, what does innovation mean to you in what you do and your role and life generally?
Yeah, no, thanks and appreciate it. I don't know if everyone here knows me, so maybe just give you a little brief background on myself. I'm the Chief Technology and Innovation Officer at NASA JPL. In Pasadena, the Jet Propulsion Lab. It's NASA's only national lab or federally funded research and development center. And it's our role to basically innovate, you know, on behalf of the government agencies. So, you know, other government agencies have, like the Department of Energy, have national labs, Lawrence Berkeley, you know, things like this. And the role of the national lab, at least in the United States, is very unique. You know, in the context that they're supposed to do kind of first-of-a-kind things, which is why JPL for NASA manages the Mars program. You know, it hasn't been commoditized. It's not, you know, commercial yet. You know, there's not just, you know, fleets of, you know, Elon hasn't completed his goal yet, you know, to have fleets of of craft and everything making their way to Mars and so on and so forth for the exploration of deep space. So we do that. We manage that on behalf of NASA. We also manage the ground telecommunications for that and managing NASA's Deep Space Network, which are three football-sized, football stadium 70-meter dishes in Canberra, Australia, Madrid, Spain, and in Goldstone, California, which is basically the way that we do all communication, commanding, getting data back from deep space missions. And it's not just the U.S. The whole world has to use the DSN because there just is nothing else like it. And so, yeah, so in my role as CTIO at JPL, we, you know, curate, we maintain the skills, the new hot ones that are necessary for innovation, like artificial intelligence, AR, VR, augmented reality, virtual reality, you know, things like that. We maintain data science, machine learning, those types of skills. And it's our job to basically infuse the talent, the ideas, the strategic roadmap and capabilities really into the existing workforce, you know, to be consultants to the, you know, motherhood and apple pie for running these sort of national and international assets for NASA and for the world. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to discussing with you, John. You know, 20 years of experience at JPL doing this and working in the field. We just finished an amazing talk yesterday about the dark web. I know about that too. We'll see if that comes up. But yeah, looking forward.
Boom, Chris, because actually innovation across all the specialisms, how you apply it and all the rest, it's going to be fantastic. I want to welcome some of the friends that have come on from the UK side. I know Keith and Chris, you're both going to have people coming in from your side, and do just spot them and bring them up. But Keith, I'm going to come to you next because actually I met Chris in one of your rooms. And for everybody who doesn't know Keith Grossman, you know, Keith is president of Time. And I have to say, when I first saw that on your biography, because you certainly don't have a lot more, I thought it was some sort of science fiction, something to do with Doctor Who or something like that, Keith, you know, which was the UK program. So President of Time, you've been very innovative in the use of this initiative, but also things like NFTs, digital art, and all of that. Do you want to say a little bit about, introduce yourself, and a little bit about what innovation means to you and what you're doing, Keith? Thank you.
Sure. Well, John, thank you. You know how I feel about you, and I feel equally as effusive about John, and I'm excited for the conversation. I appreciate you inviting me up on stage to join you guys. My name, just for people in the audience, I'm Keith Grossman. I'm the president of Time, as John had mentioned. We're originally through the fact that we both have vested interests in philanthropy, and I'm a board member of an organization called New York Cares, which is New York's smart. Been with the Time brand for a little less than 2 years now, and I joined from Bloomberg Media, and prior to that I was at Wired and Ars Technica, and I came on board to look at this storied 98-year-old brand and think, how do we think about it for the next 100 years, right? So for most people, they think about Time, and they say Time Magazine, and that happens to be, you know, correct, but it's our smallest footprint for the distribution that we have on a monthly basis, but it has the largest disproportionate impact on that footprint. And so, you know, as I think about innovation, and this is essentially what I'm usually called in for, which is turnarounds and launches and saves. What I think about is sort of like, what's the value proposition to the customer at the end of the day? And like, why do we have to do certain things a certain way? And so, you know, when you bring up the NFTs, or you bring up sort of like our move into the crypto space, which are just two examples of things that we've done recently at Time of many, you know, like a lot of it was a simple question, which is why our very real form of commerce. And so then from there, why wouldn't we accept it, you know, for digital subscriptions? It's like, why wouldn't we, if we have a cover store, why wouldn't we extend into that space? And so the question of why is usually what leads to most of the innovation. And most of our innovations occur not because others are doing it in the media space. It's because others are not doing it in the media space, but there's no rational reason why. John, is that a fair answer for you?
No, I love it, Keith. I love it. You were breaking up a little bit, but we got most of that. So undoubtedly, people follow the flow, which is great. And, you know, I mean, I think, you know, frankly, I should also say, if you see Keith Grossman opening up a Time room, go to it. It is the most extraordinary He always says his rooms are a conversation about nothing, but they become the rooms with a conversation about everything. They're the most extraordinary rooms. So please do go. The most fantastic people go in. Now, actually, I've had some other friends join us and we've come on up because I wanted to sort of kick off from the UK perspective. Well, one of my very good friends is actually in the States, but sitting immediately below you, Chris, and you might not know this, Chris, you may not know this, is one of our Knights of the Realm, Sir Tim Smith, who is one of the most innovative social entrepreneurs that I know, who created this most extraordinary Eden project in the United Kingdom, which took a disused quarry, converted it by building massive biodomes and growing a rainforest, amongst other things, in the Cornish countryside. Tim, absolutely thrilled you're up here. Thank you. I'm just going to check. Have you got absolutely zero on your profile still? Yes. So here is a man knighted by the Queen, has done the most extraordinary things, has 20 odd projects around the world, and nobody would know. Tim, how are you? What's innovation to you as we move down the line?
Oh, no, I am here.
There you go. You got your button. Okay.
I was pressing the wrong button. It's the story of my life.
There you go.
No, it's good. You always host very, very good rooms. The only thing that's missing is some very fine wine, I find. But, you know.
You can bring your own.
No, I am. I think the most extraordinary thing about your rooms and about innovation in general is how the world has changed, I think, faster than ever in history for a reason that I haven't read anything about yet. Almost every CEO I speak to, they are intent on changing the way they operate. But the reason isn't people like you or me. No. They just can't handle any more criticism from their children. You know, it's got to the point where when you've been in lockdown, you can't actually get away. So eventually the guilt has sort of like seeped in. And I think it's marvelous. I think what is really interesting is how in terms of an innovation, I think what is really happening, which really thrills me, is that the so-called establishment is breaking up. And there are people who are in the establishment making lots of money, but doing moral things, who've realized they don't have to be stupidly loyal to other people who are making money and are actually quite capable of calling people out who are polluting, who are damaging, who do not have the moral compass. And I think actually since 1989, with the wall coming down and the supposed victory of capitalism, I am really, really hopeful that we're right on the verge of a new green enlightenment, which will be fueled by a capitalism with a moral compass. So I'm delighted to join you in your room and loving the quality of the people you've got.
Thanks, Tim. Well, you're always great to contribute that sort of, you know, the grit in the oyster to get that coming. And what I'm going to do with this room tonight, folks, is I'm going through some of my good friends and those that were specifically asked to give their insights into innovation. And then we're going to open it up and we can have a general discussion about what this means. And obviously, we can bring other people up that may have comments and questions for, let's call, the panel. But Julie Lyle, you know, actually to many on this platform won't need an introduction. But, you know, I think Julie and I have known each other for about 15 years now, former CMO at Walmart, former global CMO at Prudential, Barnes & Noble, one of the top, undoubtedly one of the most insightful and top marketing gurus, as far as I'm concerned. Julie, lovely that you could join us today. Innovation, for your perspective, what would you like to add to that?
Well, thank you so much, John. I'm such a huge fan of you, as you know, and you incite them and instigate the most inspired conversations on Clubhouse. And so I'm honored to be a part of it with people on the stage and in the audience as well. So for me, innovation, you know, we say a very famous saying is that creativity is ideas, executing them is innovation. And I would agree with what's been said already that I think we're at a point, we're very close to a tipping point where, and it's happening already, the movement is certainly underway, where people are taking accountability for not only leveraging the gifts of technological advancements and computational capacity increases and new science, neuroscience, and all of the things that are sort of converging upon us, but they're not just seeing that as ways to certainly grow wonderful businesses and profits, et cetera, but in ways to make a difference that matters and to aim those advances on things that can sustain our world in a very meaningful way for generations to come. And if I can play just a nanoparticle part in that process, I'm it's thrilling for me. So thank you so much for being here. Sorry for the long ramble.
That's lovely, Julie. Nanoparticle path. That must be a NASA type phrase, Chris. I don't know. What is a nanoparticle? Can you explain?
Well, I was thinking of a quantum GPS and Scott Lang, you know, at the time, or anyways, I'll quit with the Avengers references, but yeah, we could talk about that. That's awesome.
That'll be good. That'll be good, Julie. Well, thanks for that. And actually what I've done is I've got the last two couple of people that I specifically asked in, and I brought one up actually by accident. Amy is sitting between us. I'm going to come to you in a moment, Will, but Amy is sitting between us, Chris, and to people that don't know Amy, most extraordinary entrepreneur, digital entrepreneur, innovative in terms of disrupting the online advertising platform. Her business has been going for 4 years. It generates not only tremendous revenue, obviously, as a commercial operation, but it's already in the last 3 years, I think I'm right in saying, Amy, donated as a result of your activities to charities $3.5 million in the last 3 years or something like that. Amy, what's innovation from your perspective? You've changed and you are changing that sector, but what's innovation from your side?
Thanks for that really lovely introduction, John. Hi, everyone. It's so lovely to meet you all. As John says, I run a company called Goodloop. We convert the $600 billion advertising industry into funding for amazing charities around the world. Yes, we've raised over $3 million. We work with all sorts of brands like Coca-Cola, McDonald's, Levi, Adidas, Nike. We work in 12 different markets, including the US, the UK, Australia. And we work really closely with John, actually. He's a very trusted advisor to me and my team. And so I guess I'm innovating in an industry. I've never really done it on purpose. I started in the industry as a graduate. I loved it. I learned a lot, but I also felt like there was a lot that needed changing. I mean, for those of you that don't work in advertising, it's a hard industry to love sometimes. There's a lot of opacity and fraud, and you know, half the people on the planet use ad blockers these days because advertising is so bloody annoying. And it's not, you know, you don't want to sit in the pub and some people you work in advertising and they sort of slowly shuffle away from you because they don't want to hear any more about it. Like, you want to work in an industry you're proud of. And the reality is that advertising has so much influence, so much power, so much potential, that it can really change behaviors, and it can be a powerful force for good if we use it in the right ways. So that's what drove me to innovate in advertising. That's what drove me to start Goodloop and to found my company. And I guess every step of the way, that innovation has come with constant compromise. You know, it's never this sort of idealized version of innovation where you see a new the light and you create a new enlightened route. You know, you have to work within the old systems. So we constantly are battling with things like, should we run ads on Facebook, right? Like, Facebook is it's come under a lot of heat for funding hate speech and fueling misinformation and marginalizing communities. It's not a very good platform, but it also has a huge amount of power and influence, and we can do a lot of good there. So, you know, I think I've found innovation to be something that is about seeing a better opportunity within an existing industry, and then making the small incremental changes that help everybody move in the right direction.
Thanks,
but,
Amy.
But I'm still figuring it out.
Sorry, no. Well, thanks, Amy. Well, innovation is all about constant change, isn't it? I mean, the fact is, once you innovate and you create something, you've created a change state, which then needs to be innovated again. So we're constantly building on the innovation, not only our own, but actually the innovation of others and previous generations. So I've got what I'm going to do with this room is I'm going to ask my final sort of guest speaker in just to say his view. Many will know Will. I'm going to come to him in a moment. Then we'll reset the room. And then we're going to take other thoughts or any questions to the panel from people might have, and just have a general conversation about whether or not innovation is going to be the sort of savior, frankly. And I want to hear a bit more from Chris, obviously, about innovation, what's happening on Mars and things of that kind. And we'll pipe in and see what happens. So before we get to that, Will King, King of Shaves, the brand, international business, great innovation, obviously 30 years ago, Will, when you started that business. Now you've obviously created other things as well, some of which you may talk about or may not, as the case may be. But Will, talk to us a little bit about innovation, what it means from your commercial experience, and how you see it going forward.
Thank you, John. Great room. Real pleasure to be here. So
for me, innovation, it's a restless, insatiable curiosity to change and do things for, let's just say, the better or the easier or the more satisfying or just to the nth degree. And what people probably don't know is that I studied mechanical engineering at Portsmouth Polytechnic, now university, in the mid-80s. And I've got an insatiably curious mind about why things work and what makes things happen. So to have Chris in the room from the JPL, given what's going on with the race to the Kármán layer with Jeff Bezos in about a month, you know, aiming to beat Richard Branson. I was originally booked on Virgin Galactic. I was commercial 76 on Virgin Galactic, signed up in 2007. But my wife's tigers kind of stopped me doing that now. So I was booked and was going to shave Richard. And that just shows how long that's been going, John. And in terms of innovation, it's just the restless seeking to do things better. And I think for the greater good, given the challenges that the planet faces, and I guess as an engineer, and James Dyson, I wouldn't put myself anywhere near him, but he's an engineer too. Engineering entrepreneurs, relatively rare, and hopefully over my 30-year career to date, I've been able to bring engineering problem solving to the fore. So thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you. And I know there's other things in the pipeline which you'll be declaring in the future before too long, which will be fantastic. I know people have interest in that. Now, I want to get a bit of a discussion going between Chris and Keith and Will and Tim and Julie and Amy if she comes back up. And we'll also get some questions from our other friends. I've got a lot of friends on the stage here this evening and in the audience, which is great. But before I do that, I'm going to come to James because James is the king of doing refreshes on the rooms. James, can I hand it over to you to do a room refresh? And over to you.
Thank you very much, John. Please don't put me under pressure in such illustrious company at being good at anything. I'm just pressing some buttons and hopefully it all works out for the best. But thank you very much. So let's do a quick reset. It's not very often you get a man who has fought in wars and been the right-hand guy of one of the royal family and is a legend of the Marcom space sat next to a NASA genius, who sat next to the president of Time magazine, who sat above the guy who created the Eden Project, who sat next to one of the biggest marketeers on the planet, who sat next to the guy who created King of Shaves. Basically, it's a good panel. That's what I'm getting at. Flippity flip, isn't it a good panel? Guys, we
nicely
don't often...
Nicely done, James. Nicely done.
We don't often do this, but if you'd like to add people in, please, please, please feel free to do so. Click that plus button in the bottom right-hand corner of the app. There's not many times you get an opportunity to hear a panel like this collectively together. This is the Winners Club. Enjoy the conversation. If you're not yet a member of the Winners Club, click the little green Monopoly house. You can hear more conversations like this. But let's hand back to the main gang for the art of innovation from some people who ordinarily you wouldn't get a chance to speak to, frankly.
Thanks, James. That was a great reset. Let's all just pull down the screen, refresh the screen. Chris, Keith, You're actually, the vast majority of people here, I think, are this side of the Atlantic. I don't know. You may know some of the other people in the audience, whatever, so do feel free, obviously, to bring them up, etc. But, I mean, just in reflecting on what you've heard, any thoughts that come out from your own perspectives? Keith, I'm going to come to you. I mean, Time magazine is extraordinary. It's 100 years old, isn't it? I think next year or 2 years' time, it's 100 years old. For any business to sustain itself over that period of time, it has to be innovative. It has to be of its time. No pun intended. And what you've been doing in terms of creating and humanizing the brand, as you do in your rooms, the way in which you embrace the digital agenda, etc. I mean, you know, is that an imperative now for something like yourself? And how does that manifest itself with the rest of the people involved in the Time family? Perhaps you just share a bit of that.
Sure. I mean, first off, you know, again, like that was quite an introduction. And I feel like I need to step up my game when we open up the Time community now. To rooms. You know, look, time has been around for 100 years, but the irony of the 100 years, it's 98 years, it's 98 years old, but the irony of the 98 years is that it's been around not because it's been innovative, but rather because it's just been consistent. And that was a huge benefit for a very long period of time. But like the reality is that the game plan that essentially allowed Time magazine to establish itself for the past 98 years is not going to be the game plan that's going to ensure that it's successful for the next 100 years. Now, for everyone that's on the In the UK, what you hear behind me is genuine New York City soundtrack.
It's so good. We're loving that.
And
I was going to say, that's not Pasadena, Keith.
So I am walking through Central Park right now. And so you're going to get, that's my soundtrack that you get. But like one of the reasons that I came on board was because I love that challenge, right? And, you know, earlier I had mentioned that, you know, the biggest challenge of the brand is the fact that it's Time Magazine to most people, not Time, right? And when you look at it, you know, the magazine only reaches about 1.6 million people, but every month, you know, we reach over 100 million people, right? And so here's the reality of what we're dealing with as a brand, as we think about innovation, is the magazine reaches 1.6 million people on a weekly basis, right? That tends to be primarily in their, you know, early 50s, white male, right? That's who it is. And then when you get to the website reaches 30 million people on a monthly basis, right? Who tend to be women in their 40s. And then you get to our social handles, like at Time on Twitter, that's 18 million, or, you know, Instagram, which is 10.1 million, or Facebook, which is 13.3 million. And it adds up to 70 million people who happen to be 62% under the age of 35, primarily women, primarily non-Caucasian, two-thirds outside the United States, and totally different demographic. Then you layer in the t-shirt that I'm always wearing, which is Time for Kids, and you start to realize that, like, we have 5-year-olds up to 14-year-olds. And so now all of a sudden what you start to realize is that you have a brand that has one part of it that is only reaching 1.6 million, so 1% of its entire monthly audience. And yet, when we put something on the cover, the impact of that is far greater than the 100 million people that we have or the audience that we engage with on a weekly basis. And the reason for why that dichotomy exists is twofold. One, you know, for 100 years, essentially, the brand has only been marketed as one thing, Time Magazine. It has only been branded. And it's amazing because in this moment in time, you know the brand, you know the red border, you know the trust. The downside of that is for 100 years of branding, right, and marketing is one thing, as we pull into other things and productize other things, it's hard for people to rationally put their head around. And so, like, one of our benefits happens to be that harsh realization of Time accepting cryptocurrencies, right? Like, the trust that we have is such that, like, I had to make sure that I felt so 100% comfortable and believed in the space 100%, which I do. Remember, I have a background in Wired and Ars Technica and Bloomberg, that, like, we could trust that move to be applicable to the trust of Time's sort of established brand. And so as we think about, you know, our next 100 years, it's actually not repeating the playbook that we had for the previous 100 years. It's by sort of inventing a new playbook forward for ourselves. And the reason for the change, and that's, then I'm going to shut up for a second, John, but is 3 years ago, Time was purchased by Mark and Lynn Benioff. Mark is the CEO of Salesforce. And so now a private asset of theirs, we're no longer part of sort of Meredith, which owned Time before, or Time Inc., which sold itself to Meredith. And so for the first time ever, we're able to operate as an independent brand, privately held, and also in a manner where we don't have to worry about stepping on, you know, our sister brands such as Fortune or Money or Entertainment Weekly or People or the likes. We don't have to worry about stepping on anyone's toes because we have no swim lanes anymore. We just have to do what's right for the brand.
That's incredible. So firstly, I love the backdrop. Actually, it reminds me of a city, you know, that I used to be regularly in and never here anymore. So that's quite fun. But what I'm staggered by, Keith, is that those stats, because actually, let's face it, I fit into the 1.6 million magazine monthly. And yet it had absolutely no idea of the demographic and the scale of the rest of the audiences until I didn't know about the scale, but I didn't even really consciously know they were there, such as, you know, Time for Kids and everything, until you came on this platform and I started to explore Time further. So that's fascinating. And obviously, the way in which you went right the way through to the ownership and the freedom that gives you, et cetera, quite an extraordinary opportunity there to be a free agent, isn't it, without some of the constraints of various other things, and also look longer term and all that sort of stuff as well.
So you bring up a very good sort of important point, which is, why am I on Clubhouse? Don't I have better things to do, right? Like, and the answer is actually no, right? Like, I actually find my time on Clubhouse incredibly valuable to the brand building of time, right? Because what you get on Clubhouse, unlike other social media platforms, is true engagement. Like, you could hear my voice, my intonation, whether or not you think I'm full of crap, or if you like what I'm doing, or if it's exciting, or if it's boring. You could hear how excited, I hope you hear how excited I am about what I think is the future of where we could take this story brand. But more than anything else, it humanizes a brand that has historically been a monolithic entity. And that, to me, is the value of Clubhouse, the value of these type of engagements, these discussions, is converting people like yourself and others one at a time over to realize that the Time brand can be just so much more. And because it's such a well-known brand, it's not a hard leap for us to ask people to just take a look, just check it out.
Keith, I'm so impressed that you put all that effort into opening rooms just to convert me. I mean, I have to say that was an extraordinary effort, and I hope it's been worth it. No, but I mean, really, Chris, and then we'll, you know, let's take some pop mics after we talk again to Chris. So, Chris, you have got your rover roaming around Mars and all the rest of it. You know, I mean, where does that other world aspect of innovation, which you're so focused on, how does that apply itself to the teams in NASA and everything on a day-to-day basis, the rest of your life, your observations? Just interested how you stay grounded, frankly, in the real world, not the real world, on the Earth world and everything that we're coping with here, when your mind is obviously about innovation in the other world of space, if that makes sense.
Yeah, John and Keith, and we didn't even talk about the multiverse yet. Hey, you know, I was trying to, you know, think about, you know, what Keith was saying, and, you know, I respect the hell out of Keith a lot. It's been a pleasure getting to know him and John, you know, over this time. And I think what Keith was talking about was, you know, especially with the brand of time and everything, and I'm going to relate this back to NASA, is like, what are the important questions, you know, that they're trying to solve? And then, you know, what of those questions kind of requires the innovation that's necessary to kind of get there? And so all those numbers you heard Keith just rattle off, all those, you know, demography, the, you know, size, the volume, the velocity, the veracity, the scale, you know, of what he was talking about led him to do everything that he's doing, John. And, you know, I know this isn't about, you know, Keith, you want me to talk about NASA, but I just want to kind of relate. That's what drives innovation. You know, you start out with a big set of questions. You know, so for NASA, you know, for the National Aeronautics and Space Agency here in the U.S., the questions are, you know, they're also equally big. How do we protect Mother Earth? How did the universe form? Where is it going? Can we find an Earth 2.0? How do we divert an asteroid? Because that's going to be important to us later for, you know, minerals and mining and things like that, and also for our evolution. And then was there life on Mars? Because, you know, someday we might need, you know, another planet, you know, depending on the way we treat this one. And, you know, some of the science have told us thus far, you know, there's some things that we're doing that aren't good, you know, and so forth to it. And so those questions, just like Keith's questions, you know, how do I take the, you know, 1.6 million, you know, classic magazine subscribers, you know, for this and their demography? And then, you know, how do I bring it up to date with the, you know, really the reality, you know, that's the internet today and the multi, you know, modal and multifaceted ways that people engage where the demography looks a lot different? You know, I mean, if you wouldn't have told me Keith's job, I would have told you he was a data scientist, giving everything he kind of just went through. And actually, what's really interesting about that too, John, is that those types of questions, starting and walking backwards from those questions, is exactly, you know, what we do with innovation. You know, so I gave you some of the examples, you know, with NASA and Mars. You know, let's take the one, was there life on Mars related to that? You know, that sort of sets the strategy. Okay, well, how are we going to figure that out? You know, what do we need? Okay, the strategy is we need to know if there's or was there life on Mars. And so what do we need? We need innovation to do that. We have national assets. We can communicate to Mars. But hell, getting off of the Earth and getting things launched in orbit's pretty hard itself. And actually, it's a changing game in that. You know, NASA was very used to doing this all alone, you know, for many years as a civilian space agency in the U.S. You know, we like to joke sometimes with JPL, you know, Keith's talking about 100 years, you know, of time and things like that. With JPL, we say it's an 80-year startup. You know, it's a, you know, it was founded in the Arroyo Seco right outside of Pasadena. There's some interesting murder mysteries that happen there involving, you know, people up to Rockefeller. I recommend people checking that out, the history of the Arroyo Seco near Pasadena and what Wernher von Braun and others did when they were experimenting with rockets there to get us there today. That is, the modern JPL is a clubhouse room in its own. It's actually the subject of a few novels. But, you know, beyond that, you know, thinking about that, okay, we need to get to Mars. We need to do it in a different way. Commercial since 2008 and the strategy there to move away from NASA's SLS and really to partner with industry and where SpaceX is now, lots changing, you know, in terms of the way that we do that. Not for near Earth. I mean, near Earth is such an interesting space. Commercial is heavily involved in that. Small sats, CubeSats, you know, what people are doing, you know, in terms of providing kind of core infrastructure and capability there is very interesting. But deep space in Mars is deep space in Mars, and there are only a few places that have the necessary technologies and capabilities and innovation and facilities that you need to kind of get there and do that. So, you know, I'm trying to lay out a strategy here. You know, you have a strategy, you've got technologies, you've got facilities, and then you need people. And to maintain that churn in a little bit, you need to, you know, KYC, know your customer. And so for us, the customer at NASA isn't just all the smart people and engineers and scientists, you know, that want to know, hey, is and was there life on Mars? It's really the world. If, you know, the KYC analysis for us for innovation is everyone that watched that rover land on Mars and that started to ask questions about why it has a helicopter called Ingenuity on it, or that started to say, oh, wow, it's got this amazing sky crane system, and I can look up a video on YouTube for the 7 minutes of terror, and it's going to describe why JPL and NASA needed to completely and fundamentally change the way that we drop big hunks of metal on Mars to explore it. Because the way that we used to do it was we wrapped it in effectively a big balloon or set of them and let the balloon bounce, which is what we did, you know, with the Spirit and Opportunity rovers in 2003-04, all the way to now we literally have a sky crane with retro rockets. The 2012 version of that, you know, for Curiosity, you know, was amazing in itself. It, you know, the retro rockets fire, it lowers this, you know, one-ton hunk of metal, which is the size of a Volkswagen bus on Mars, get ready for exploring with the experiments on it, to, you know, today, the 2020 Perseverance rover, you know, it didn't just have the sky crane, it actually had AI called Terrain Relative Navigation. It was looking as it was landing because Jezero Craters, you know, kind of got a lot of rocks and other stuff in it. We didn't want to mess up our $2.5 billion investment, you know, and especially its internal payload of that helicopter that we wanted to test fly. So, you know, the people, the KYC you're capturing, the partners that we needed to work together, the instruments that our partners built internationally to put on that amazing thing. And then finally, you know, in the framework of innovation, you need results that matter, right? That bring people together during a pandemic, that allow us to explore, answer those big questions, you know, that we're talking about. And then finally, I'll shut up. And I'm really interested in everyone's, you know, take on this. And this, you know, Keith is, and you, John, are just amazing at this. It's the celebrations of bravery. Innovation takes bravery, and if you don't get any recognition or merit or credit, you know, after doing that, you know, it kind of, you know, gets a little old, you know, saving the world or doing things like that. So celebrating that bravery is another key component to innovation. So thank you.
Chris, I love that bit, that celebration. You've brought a lot of things up there. I mean, actually, for many of us, if you think about what you just described there, it's almost unfathomable for a simple lad like me to get my head around the multiple layers of complexity and innovation to every element of that journey, of every element of that component, various components, is extraordinary. And the only way you can get a grasp is if people like yourselves can communicate it and break it down and talk about strategies and technology and people and results that matter and things of that kind, because then at least you can try and route them to your own experience, however different that has been. And I do think that that aspect of being innovative takes courage is a critical aspect. We all know, I bet you everybody on this platform and in the audience knows that, at any time where you've gone beyond what's comfortable, which I think is a critical component of innovation, that is where you actually have some sort of courage, because you know that there's so much risk involved. Now, that risk might be a spacecraft, but it equally might be launching a business like Will, or it might be creating this extraordinary vision of Eden down in Cornwall. There's a huge risk associated with any of that. And when it does come off, then people do need to have that celebrated, undoubtedly. I'm going to sort of go.
John, wait, John, can I just jump in on that? Because like what you said is so spot on. And like I always equate it to, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Have you seen this movie?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So like there's that scene where they're in the temple and he has to walk onto the invisible bridge, right? And yeah. It's just like, and his father whispers to him, it's just like, just trust me, right? And like, I once asked Chris Anderson, who was the editor-in-chief of Wired, you know, way back when he came out with the idea of the long tail, I said to him, is like, what is like true innovation? And he said, leading from a blank page. And like the idea of that and the invisible bridge to me is always the feeling that I get when we take a risk, right? Like, oh, I'm out here by myself. Am I going to fall and go down a million times? And by the way, I fail all the time. So like, I just want to put that out there. Like I fail way more than I succeed, but like that feeling is that feeling in your gut, it's so exciting to take that step forward, but it is also so utterly terrifying.
And I bet you can imagine Jeff Bezos saying to his brother, just trust me.
Yeah, I find that extraordinary. Nobody's interviewed the brother, have they? I find that extraordinary. Did anybody actually ask him whether or not he wanted to go or not?
I think he's busy making a four-dimensional map of his brother in case anything has to go wrong and he can reprint him. Anyways.
But I mean, to be fair, Will, you were signed up. Okay, so you were signed up onto Richard Branson's
conversations in NASA happen around, we have limited payload we can take up there. Should we, how do we determine what is the best use of those resources? Is it to test a helicopter or a refrigeration unit or whatever? I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but those conversations about how you prioritize innovation, because in so many aspects, of course, I have a deep corporate background, but sometimes the prioritization process itself derails all innovation because you can't reach consensus on which trial should trump others. Can you speak?
Yeah, Julie, and you know, it's a really, you know, interesting kind of, I would say, multifaceted, you know, problem. But what it comes down to, I think, are those heroes, you know, that basically know how to take a bunch of very complex thing, and data and input, and like Keith said, not always make the best decision, but not be afraid to make the wrong decision. You know, like forever, you know, like in computing, which is sort of second nature to me, it's kind of where I came from. You know, the theory was that, and this will, I think, make sense to hopefully a lot of people here. The theory was you needed to buy these, you know, 20 years ago, these big silicon graphics, you know, just machines that never went down. And you had to pay for big support contracts that went along with them, because reliability was really those support contracts and machines and this exquisite hardware. And Google and Larry Page and Sergey Brin out of Stanford changed fundamentally that paradigm. They said, you know what? Actually, we can take computers that you buy at, you know, a local electronics store, Fry's here in the US, which doesn't exist anymore but did before. You could put those together in a commodity way. And you can solve the reliability problem through duplication, through duplicity, through basically reducing the mean time to recover from failure, basically accepting failure and saying, you know what, we need to make it so that when we fail, it doesn't take 25 years to recover, you know, it takes 25 minutes. That fundamental philosophy is basically approximation. And it's a key to innovation, in my opinion. It's not making the perfect decision, but it's, you know, being real about the confidence that we have, the trade-offs amongst it, and making some decision, you know, that you have the capability to do. So, you know, the reason, say, Ingenuity, you know, the helicopter went on that payload is that, I'll just give you a quick, you know, story for that, is that, you know, if we were to call that a part of the flagship mission for Mars 2020, that helicopter would have never made it on there. In other words, if we would have said the mission will fail without the helicopter, it would not have gone on the rover. And what the folks, the smarter folks than me together, you know, decided is the proper way to kind of include that helicopter as part of the mission was to call it a technology demonstration that actually de-risked a number of things that were important to us, but not necessarily fundamental to, say, you know, finding if there was life on Mars and today or 2021, you know, but by de-risking it, by putting this helicopter that had a test of the Qualcomm Snapdragon and things like that, not only would we be able to see, hey, can we...
Right? More. And so they played to that commercial reasons. For us, we had so much rebuilding to do and so much infrastructure building to do that, like, we just wanted to stick to our core of build a better future. And we liked the niche of rational centric perspective that, like, we felt that for a long play, it just played out better because, you know, in every instance where there's populism, there's always a moment where it settles again. I do agree with you, though. Like, I don't personally like extreme points of view. There is a great Japanese phrase that translated into English is the nail that sticks up the highest is the first to get knocked down. And I think that what you're seeing in economics, in subscriptions, and in advertising flows to the brands that were the most extreme to both the left and to the right is that marketers and consumers are now moving out of a populist moment and are moving away from renewing those things. And so I think we're now moving into a more normalized, rational state. And so for the past 4 years, probably, I joked that the best job in marketing was being the brand manager of Xanax. And I would probably argue that that's probably a challenged job right now.
Keith, if I could just might jump in. So being president of Time, for me, is like an entrepreneur sort of guy. So for me, it's like immediately in my world is hashtag. It's about time, yeah? Not just time to change, but time is the one thing, 86,400 seconds each and every day, that we can never get back, yeah? So I think you as president of Time and, you know, publications out there leading the art and the education of innovation and change for the better, you know, what a pinnacle position to be in for you, reaching probably hundreds of millions of individual readers each and every month.
Look, we take it very seriously. Like, I would say everything, like, and this is kudos to the editorial team, like everything that we do when we put it out, we really try to breathe it. Even on like EDI stuff, you know, we put out an issue where, you know, it was written by the BIPOC employees. And like, we acknowledged, like, we are not perfect, right? But we are striving towards being better. And like, here's the things that we're doing. And so like, what we are trying to do is just lead by example and be core to people who believe in this notion of build a better future, right? And that is inherently optimistic and that is inherently inclusive. And then I'm going to shut up for a few minutes because I just want to just listen to Chris talk about how NASA lies about, you know, timeframes. But
it's a spectrum.
So I would say that Kevin Kelly, who was one of the founders of Wired, has this incredible... He has two incredible quotes. One is that there's no technology that's ever been invented for good that can't be used for bad, or vice versa. And then the other one, though, and I love, is this notion that, you know, the future is always written by optimists in the long run. And so, like, that's the one that constantly has me sort of racking my brain, is the future is always written by optimists.
That's a great one, Keith. I'm going to dive in here now because we've got about probably half an hour left of the room, and I want to give some of the people that have come on up a chance to ask a few questions. I've also brought up, well, Emily Lyons has come in. So, Emily, welcome. I've put you there in the place of Julie, so you may get some questions as well. You're a great innovative campaigner and friend of many of us here on this platform, so that's great to see you there. Thank you. Lindsay, are you back? You're flashing your mic. Have you got better signal now? To
yeah, I do. Sorry about that.
No, go ahead with your question.
No problem. Thanks, John. I was just really loving, I just wanted to say thank you so much for putting this room together. You know, I love your talks. I'm usually Lindsay on the horse here, as most people know me. Today I'm elephants. I'm not sure if you guys heard me say that, but it's because I really feel like this kind of a group coming together is a manifestation of really what, I mean, I think the animals have been telling us, the earth has been telling us for a long time, is that, you know, to really bridge these divides, you need to get the technical side of this world to come together with the conservationists to really create a new place here. You know, I really lean into what Tim is saying, especially about how there's so much that we can do here with regard to just creating life and sustaining life that we've just like left and taken for granted. And I just wanted to say that I just really appreciate what you're doing, John, with this stage, because this is what Clubhouse is all about, putting these conversations together so that you can really create and inspire change. You know, Tim is actually, it's amazing that he's here. I just wanted to say to him that you know, I'm emulating what Tim's doing in Los Angeles with the Eden Project right now by saving 32 chimpanzees that are, 7 of them are supposed to be moved in 2 weeks, and we're fighting to save them. And one of the largest green spaces, 167 acres there, and it's going to be a tech accelerator. That's the goal, is to bring in AI, machine learning, you know, computational management. I mean, all kinds of amazing things, you know, visual computing to this property with startups and founders. And I just love the fact that Keith is here, you know, because Keith is always right on with time and being like, I've been on so many stages with Keith, and he's so forward thinking with capturing these moments that shape our lives. Like, it was really moving to see all of you here. And then Julie actually is on my board too. So yeah, it was just really neat to see this. So just thank you so much for doing this and facilitating these kinds of conversations, because this is what we need. We just need more conversations. So I guess my question would be, what's next? What would you guys see that we should focus on to really, I think, enhance founders, to bring them, you know, to I think, bridging conservation and sustainable technology, aside from obviously the U.S. just passed this great bill, you know, 250, or it's billions of dollars. I'm not even sure what the number is, I guess, but it's some very large amount toward, you know, funding these kinds of things. You know, what do you see in the world? Because I know everyone's kind of coming from different places. What can we do to help, you know, enhance founders and looking at both sides?
That's a great question, Lindsay. And so let's just focus down very quick. You know, let's get some quick responses to this, because it sort of is similar to what we've been discussing, but it's absolutely about how the sustainability of the planet, the species. You know, I love the fact that, you know, we have to become more rooted in terms of understanding, appreciate that we are part of nature. I love this term earthling. I'm sure that's from science fiction or something. You know, you imagine somebody saying, earthling, you know, we are here to speak to your leader. But what would we do? I mean, if I go back to what Chris said earlier, he talked about strategies, he talked about technology, and he talked about people. There are a heck of a lot of people out there that want something to change in the sustainability environmental space. You know, where are the strategies? What's the technology? Any quick thoughts on that? And obviously, we're looking at you, Tim, to a great extent on this, but others pipe in as well.
I think one of the things is our own arrogance as humans. We have a 10,000 acre rainforest in Costa Rica, which we are, which was 42 derelict farms, where the land was actually desert and there was drought. And the original philanthropist who bought it, he put a fence around it. He said, no humans in here. The birds will crap it back to life. Unbelievably, today, there is a 10,000 acre rainforest. The nearby town of 8,000 souls believes they've had the second coming of Christ, because there's four rivers running 365 days a year. The biodiversity has gone up by 10% per year for the last five. Last year, for the first time, there were pumas and ocelot, and 3 months ago, there were jaguars. And now we're working with a marvelous chocolate company called Hotel Chocolat, who are going to plant wild cacao for the people of Paquera, the village, to actually be able to create livelihoods in the rainforest, as opposed to cutting it down, but working with it. And that's got to be the future. We've got to trust nature. It knows a thing or two. And I'm sure Chris, if he was answering, would talk about the way that perhaps the way the world is going to change technologically is to look more closely at the systems of nature, because neural networks and systems thinking is the future, isn't it?
Wait, Tim, are you saying that the more people that are full of shit, the better the planet?
The more people that are full of shit. That is such a good way of putting it. Keith, I love you. That's fantastic. Yes.
As long as there's not too much methane.
Yeah, but seriously, Tim, we've talked about this project in Costa Rica. For me, and I know I've flagged it up with Keith, I think, in the past, whatever, we've got to get people in North America understanding what's happening in Costa Rica. That is an extraordinary example of how actually you can let nature, if you can let nature regenerate itself, there's an opportunity to do that. And it can become a great asset then in supporting the villages and things around it. So, you know, there's a story to be told there. Chris, you wanted to come in.
Look, John, I mean, we know what's happening with Costa Rica. It is La Nublar. They're making dinosaurs. They've tried it a few times, and it didn't work out, all right? You know? And anyways, if you hang out with me long enough, you're going to get a bunch of pop culture references. I apologize. I'm kind of like that annoying Tom Holland guy from
Spider-Man. Wouldn't it be great, though? Wouldn't it be great? I mean, you know, can't we sort of get, you know, woolly mammoths back? I mean, where I am, in a little sleepy village in the depths of Shropshire, in a little country called England on the northwest side of a continent called Europe, we found a whole load of mammoth, you know, bones, and, you know, mammoth skeletons probably 25, 30 years ago. Wouldn't it be extraordinary to see those beasts arrive? But actually, of course, wouldn't it be, I was looking at the photograph that Lindsay's had. Now, if you don't know, that is actually a wandering wandering family of elephants across China that's being monitored because it is literally going on some great trek. When you look at that family, you look at an elephant, you think to yourself, how the hell can we ever run the risk that we don't have elephants on this planet or any other species, every little bird that's in the garden or whatever? We have to have that energy, that commitment, that innovation to make that happen.
If I could interrupt you just a second, you know, and actually make a serious comment, we do. And actually, relating back to what Tim just said, you know, too, and you know, I don't want to get on my high horse for deep learning and AI, but we need to look at, you know, both nature, human and biological physiology, and look at it at various levels to understand and model not only like the fundamental, you know, things that are going on today. You know, you ask yourself, why do you have a digital home assistant and it can understand you? Because we learned the human auditory system. It was a pretty kick-ass model. And hey, you know, if we're building neural networks, why don't we try and doing that? Why do we have the potential for smart cars today? Because, you know, your visual cortex and the way that it scans and, you know, makes convolutions to basically determine objects and what labels to assign to them, that's a pretty kick-ass model. Hey, we ought to try that. And so beyond, you know, replicating and emulating life and biology and humans, and you look at a systems level, what you're talking about, John, is the combination of all that too into nature, and what can we learn and how can we be influenced from that? So we need to learn and model that, look at the innovations there. And then, like, you look at technology, you're talking about, like, how do we bring, you know, things back, or how do we do it? Well, that's only because the tools that we have, as we look at the models, some of them have evolved scarily, scary good. You look at CRISPR, you know, gene cutting, the ability to do things like that. I mean, hell, look at COVID and the response to that with the vaccines in the West, and as they're getting out with COVAX and in other places, to places that need them. The mRNA technology and capability. So the tools now in biology and space and AI, you know, we need to model what we want. We need to define the innovations and the people and the skills to get there. But also, John, and I'll shut up now, we need to be respectful of how we got here and the power of some of these tools and use them in an ethical way.
I love it, Chris. I've just been nodding away totally on that. You can't see me nodding, but I'm nodding, and people are flashing their mics as well. So with that, and as time moves on, who would like to ask a question of this extraordinary group of pals that I'm proud to call pals up here? I'm looking down the panel. Anybody on the stage that would like to ask a question, flash their mics. Yes. Okay, Connor, hi. Good to see you here. Connor, what's your question or thought around innovation?
Hey, John. Yeah, thanks for having me. It's an extraordinary conversation, guys. Yeah, I was just thinking there with everything that said, innovation needs to be unique, obviously, and problem solving, but I think progressive and sustainable, and that was mentioned as well. But I think younger people, obviously, due to technology, have less concentration. You know, we think of these 3-second worlds with regard to videos and so on, the first couple of seconds. And with sustainability, it requires innovation that's going towards like more simplification, like no longer looking, say, outside the box, but creating like another shape altogether that's progressive, sustainable. And I think we need to get into education and show youth that like, their lack of focus and concentration drives people to look short term. And that nature requires a more longer term, obviously, approach that we've found out in our lifetimes. So what do you guys like think of the need for like just getting that sustainability but progression into education a little bit more?
Good so question. Will. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, if I can just jump in here. I hate sustainability and sustainable. Yeah, it's been so highly weaponized by marketeers and big companies. Yay, you can be sustainable, and it's all really amazing and it's good, but nothing in life, including our lives, is sustainable. Yeah, we live an arc, a trajectory, and we're here and then we're not here. So I would love there to be much more of a dialogue around the importance of responsibility. With great power comes great responsibility. There isn't a saying, with great power comes great sustainability. And injecting that into our young people and our old people as well. Yeah, I'm a sort of Gen X, parents of boomers, we've got millennials, my lad's Gen Z. The importance of responsibility, in my opinion, in the world we live at, if we all took that seriously, the world could change, I think, very quickly, very fast. But I think we've been hijacked by sustainability as almost now yeah, I'm sustainable, it's all good, move on. And I think that's entirely wrong.
Great response there. Can I just ask everybody, refresh the rooms, pull the screen down and refresh. If you aren't following the Winners Club, then please tap the little greenhouse above Chris's head. This is an extraordinary group of people that we've got on stage here. My guests, Chris, Keith, Tim, Will, and we've got Emily up as well, and a few other great friends that we have in the room. So has anybody got a question that they, any more questions that they'd like to ask around innovation? Yes, Jennifer, hello. Jennifer English, I see you there. What would you, your question to the panel?
I'm deeply grateful that this panel has convened at this unique moment in time. I'm grateful for the privilege of being on the stage. My name is Jennifer English, and I am the editor-at-large of Food and Beverage Magazine. Sir Tim, it's an honor to be here in the space with you, and I have a question that I hope you can help us consider. We talk about Costa Rica and how the natural flow of the wisdom of the planet and the universe has allowed this incredible desert to be turned into a lush rainforest. Some might argue that the pandemic has done to the hospitality industry what the desert experienced. How do we allow the hospitality industry, which is the cultural rainforest for us as humans, where we have the most important moments of our lives, employing millions and creating a sense of a locus for our culture and community and for the world of food and the fine art of hospitality and edibles. How can we use this awareness of what's happened in Costa Rica and be inspired to reimagine and recreate, and as they say at the Buckminster Fuller Foundation, create regenaissance for the hospitality industry in a way that is akin to the genius of what happened in Costa Rica? I'm so deeply grateful for the opportunity to have this moment and this conversation. Thank you all.
Well, what a very good question. I think the future of sustainable tourism has been actually laid right open by the pandemic. And I've read probably the best articles I've ever read about it recently, especially in New Zealand, where the whole country is going towards what they're calling sustainable tourism. But with respect to Will and his natural anathema to the phrase, which I actually share, what they're talking about is actually reframing the economic relationship between those things called eateries, hotels, and all the rest of it, to the local community. So you get a much wider stakeholder group because people realize that the beauty of wherever it is requires everybody in that community to act as citizens to make it remain so beautiful, in which case you need to actually get the buy-in from everybody who is around your hotel or bar or whatever to create something or maintain something magnificent. I know it sounds a bit hippie talk, but for example, with what we've done at the Eden Project, we deliberately set out to encourage the supply chains that supplied us to become ever better in terms of sustainability, and we used capitalism in a rather unusual way, which is that we rewarded the good behavior and good practice of those that supplied us across a wide range of metrics. We rewarded them with ever longer contracts, and that then led to them making their suppliers behave better and better and better. And I think it's very little understood the power of good business in affecting really good outcomes. I'll stop now.
Tim, great answer, Tim. Thank you for that. Jennifer, thank you for the question. We've got about 10 minutes left in this room. So who else flash their mics would like? Sunny, do I see you there? Sunny, you've got a question?
Hi.
Okay, come to you first, Sunny, and then we'll come to you.
Oh, yeah, hi there, John. Yeah, I just wanted to get... I just wanted to sort of explain in India, sort of being British Indian myself, there's something called Jagad, which means like sort of the makeshift of innovation. And I've sort of, for example, something beforehand free existed would be somebody sing, such as a turban, tying the phone to his face and basically using that as a hands-free. And just on the innovation side, like, it's just been amazing seeing how sort of a lot of work is outsourced to India via sort of technology, the virtual assistants and whatnot. I just wanted to get your view on, like, the international sort of meaning for innovation in different countries, because talking about it here is like completely sort of Western side of it, and just wanted to see your views on, like, different parts of the world where they use innovation in their own way.
Yeah. Great question. Anybody got a thought on that? I've got a pretty pretty narrow-minded perspective, I guess, coming from the Northern Hemisphere, etc. Who can add into that?
Can I jump in on that one for a second, John? Because, like, I have found when I was at Bloomberg, I in my prior life, I just spent a tremendous amount of time on the road traveling. And there were a few things that I found as I just went around the world that I thought was absolutely fascinating. One was, while, yes, a lot of innovation was local, like, a lot of innovation was very similar and different at the same time. So, like, if you took in the United States or, you know, in most of Europe, something like Uber or Lyft, right? Like, you had very similar services on the top end, such as Grab in Asia. But what you started to see was, like, underneath the surface, they started to evolve and create infrastructure that maybe in some countries that had not emerged as fast as other established countries, solved a lot of problems for the local community. So a lot of the technologies or innovation that I witnessed firsthand happened to be because these countries, as they started to emerge onto the global scene and really accelerate their economies, they were able to leapfrog a lot of the infrastructural investments that took place in Western countries. And so, like, that's where I found a lot of, like, some of the most interesting innovations as it related to, you know, like, what was happening outside of the United States or outside of Europe. But at the same time, like, you saw a tremendous amount of similarities too, right? So car sharing, like, sharing things that, you know, maximized people's time, things that made people more efficient, right? And I think that as you think about innovation in general, like, don't think in terms of products, think in terms of trends that tap into all of humanity. So, like, people have limited amount of time, right? Like, people create filter bubbles for themselves. People, there's an incredible amount of data out there. So, like, what are the innovations that are occurring around the highest level macro things that are essentially inevitable in terms of how they apply or where they apply? And then you could start to map out individual cultures and how they are sort of evolving against those.
I think that's a great response, Keith. And actually, of course, we know that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, and you can talk about that as innovation as well. I mean, the fact is, if you need to find a solution and you don't have the things that are there to do it, you will create that new solution. So that often will come out of the toughest of environments or the hardest and most deprived areas or different social aspects that then can be transferred elsewhere. I've certainly seen that, and that's a great illustration. It's always good to bring great people together for good conversation. Clubhouse has allowed me to do that. It's allowed me to meet new people, such as those, you know, on the stage, but also bring old friends in as well, like Will and Tim and others. And I think that we all are here because we enjoy the richness of different insights, the ability to get different perspectives and things like that. I want to go to Chris for any final words before we close the room, because I'm a great one for thinking, you know, keep people asking for more and wanting more. Chris, you do some rooms as well, perhaps. And also, indeed, I'm sure the Winners Club, if diaries would allow, would probably love to host you on one of their other rooms as well. And of course, we'll have other conversations. But Chris, do you want to reflect on the room before we get to hand over to James to close it?
Just amazing perspectives, John. And, you know, the thing I want to say too is John's telling everyone to go follow the speakers and whatever, and John's not talking enough about himself, although maybe people would disagree with me. But I think we need to thank John. Thank you, John, for putting this together. This really was all him, and with a lot of help, but it was his genesis, his idea. He's a connector, amazing. Whether you served, and in the military, and whatever you did, well, I don't know, was the managing director for the Prince of Wales. That's pretty freaking cool. And we managed, I think, to tie these things together. The one thing to take away with innovation is don't be afraid to fail, in my opinion, and try and get back up as fast as possible. That's the key, in my opinion. It's been such a pleasure. I'd love to be part of further rooms, and this has been an amazing session. Thank you, everyone.
Well, thanks, Chris, for those kind words, and thanks for your time. And let's do more rooms like this together. There's no two ways about that. Before we sign off, I have to say two things which my daughter said to me when I explained that we'd been talking and everything before this room. She said there were two things, really, that I need. One is she doesn't mind paying for it, but she wants a sweatshirt with NASA on because none of her friends have got it. And also that my nephew wants to work at NASA. That's another job. But actually, what she did say is, why can't we just leave Mars alone? We've messed up this planet. Why do we go and have to mess up everybody else's planet? Now, that surely is going to be the title for another room, perhaps, Chris. But I leave that with a huge smile on my face. Huge thanks to everybody that's made this room happen. And huge fat thanks to everybody in the audience who has found this enriching as well. So my final thing is to hand over to James of the Winners Club. It is a club for winners, and you don't have to come onto the stage to be that. So James, over to you, and thank you everybody as we sign out.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Winners Club. If you have taken some practical lessons and learnings from some of the most impactful conversations on Clubhouse, then we would love your support for this show by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts.